Hello and welcome to the Money Talk podcast. I'm Ed Monk. Today on the show, after a brief break for the summer, we are back with a look at what's turning out to be a good year for income hunting investors. And then we'll ask what fast rising house prices mean for potential inheritance tax bills. If you enjoy the show, please rate us, share us, or leave a comment wherever you get your podcasts. Dividends were one of the first casualties in the financial markets when the pandemic struck last year. Companies suddenly saw a huge question mark over their expected earnings, and payments to shareholders were an obvious area to cut back. Some sectors, like the banks, were ordered to halt their payments. As 2021 has progressed, however, the picture has improved and many dividends have returned. How much more is there to come, and is it too late to take advantage of this resurgence for dividends? To help answer that, I'm joined by Fidelity Investment Director Tom Stevenson. Tom, welcome. Perhaps we can start with a whistle-stop tour of the past year for dividends, their sudden fall in 2020 and their recovery this year.
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, Ed. Well, I mean, if you remember a year ago, the earnings environment was very different. As we know, the pandemic was in full flood and earnings were under a lot of pressure. And of course, dividends are paid out of earnings and they are a discretionary payment. So if a company is feeling nervous about the outlook for their earnings, then one of the first things that they are likely to cut is the dividend. And that certainly happened. We saw a very sharp fall in dividend payments last year. Now, of course, as we know, we've had, you know, a very sharp recovery, a V-shaped recovery in the economy and in corporate earnings, and that has started to feed through into dividends as well, as you might expect. And so we've seen many of the dividends that were cut or deferred or reduced a year ago being brought back this year. So the outlook for dividends is much better this year than it was 12 months ago.
Yeah, and thinking back to last year, Tom, as you say, the cuts to dividends were widespread, but you can probably now, with the benefit of hindsight, you can put those into various groups, can't you? There were companies that simply were always going to have a huge problem with the pandemic. Travel, hospitality, you know, lockdown's going to, you know, affect those businesses in a sort of existential sort of way. They were in a fight for their own survival. So obviously they had to cut dividends. You also had companies who I suppose maybe feared a hit to their business, but they saw a dividend cut as being sort of more prudent, if I can put it that way, particularly if a company was taking furlough money, say. On the one hand, it's very difficult for them to then continue payments to shareholders. And then I guess there's maybe some companies, Tom, and I know you sort of hinted at this in some of the things you've written in recent weeks about dividends, but there might have been some companies who simply saw an opportunity to sort of correct their dividend or lower their dividend at a time when the market wouldn't punish them for doing that in maybe the way that they would normally be punished.
Yes, I mean, I think that's quite a useful framework for looking at those dividend cuts, because there were a number of different reasons for the cuts. I mean, we know that the Bank of England, for example, told banks that they were not allowed to pay dividends. There's not much they could do about that. And as you say, some other businesses were, paying a dividend was very low on their list of priorities. They were in the business of just staying in business, surviving, as you say. But I think that third group is quite interesting, because I think where we've got to, and this happens over time, is that because companies are they want to pay a rising dividend because investors like that. So there is a temptation to keep increasing the dividend over time. And I think many companies probably found themselves in a position where they were paying out more in dividend than was probably sensible. And so I think that when they looked around and they saw many other companies cutting their dividends, this was an opportunity for them to cut their own dividend. They had the cover of the pandemic to give them an excuse for doing it, if you like. They were able to keep more money in the business. And in the long run, that probably will work out to be, you know, a good thing for investors in those businesses. You do need to keep a certain amount reinvested in the business to keep it growing. But undoubtedly, some businesses did take that opportunity.
Yeah, and this is where we can mention one of the metrics that people look at when they're assessing dividends, which is dividend cover. It's the amount by which a dividend is covered by the earnings of a company, essentially, right, Tom? And that presumably will have improved in aggregate, and obviously for certain individual companies as well.
Yes, that's right. I mean, you know, a very obvious rule of thumb is that, you know, a company shouldn't be paying out more in dividend than they are earning in profits. But actually, you know, you want to be a bit more prudent than that. And I think that, you know, most people would like to see, you know, at least 1.5 or maybe even 2 times the dividend being earned in profits. That would suggest to an investor or a potential investor that dividend was A, sustainable, and B, had the possibility of growing in years to come. What we're seeing at the moment is that the number of companies which have that cushion, that sort of 1.5 times earnings to dividend cover ratio, is much higher than it was before the pandemic. So yes, the sustainability of earnings has actually improved quite significantly. And probably just one further point to make about the dividend outlook at the moment is that, you know, traditionally a small number of sectors have accounted for a very large proportion of the dividends that are paid in the UK market. So typically the banks have been high dividend payers, commodity companies have paid good dividends, and so have oil and gas companies. Now, for various reasons, in recent years, all three of those sectors have been under the cosh, and they have struggled. In the last year or so, the outlook has really improved for all three of those. The oil price has risen, demand for commodities has risen, and the economic environment has improved for the banks, and the interest rate environment has improved for the banks. So for those three very important dividend paying sectors, I think the prospects for dividends to be paid and for dividends to grow over time are significantly better now than they were.
Well, that leads me on, Tom, to my next question, which is whether or not this still represents an opportunity for investors. I mean, the market, as we know, prices in changes in dividends almost immediately. So, you know, a dividend comes online and the price of that company will rise until the dividend is sort of reaches what the market thinks is a fair value in terms of the share price. So can it be that you can still take advantage of this sort of environment, which we say is improving from a dividend point of view? Is there more to come from dividend improvements, would you think?
Well, I think the key point here is that when you're investing for income, when you're looking for dividends to support your investment strategy, a really important question is that sustainability of the dividend payment. And I think, you know, go back 2 years ago, and I think there were probably quite a lot of question marks over dividends. You know, you might not have had that sort of degree of reassurance that those dividends could be paid. Now, for the reasons that we've said, companies taking the opportunity to cut their dividends, etc., and the improving outlook, I think that I think investors can have much greater reassurance now that if they see an attractive dividend yield of sort of 3.5%, 4%, 5%, which is, you know, very achievable in today's market, I think that you can have a much greater sense of confidence that dividend will actually be maintained in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And like any investing, you know, investing for dividends, you need to be diversified in what you're buying. So you might see very eye-catching one-off dividends here and there. But if you're buying lots of dividend-paying companies because you want that diversity, it's this sort of overall picture that you should be more concerned with. And as we've said, you know, dividend cover has improved. The yield on the market overall is still decent here in the UK. So that it should give people a bit more confidence that they'll get a decent level of income.
Yes, I think that the point you make there about diversification is important, because, you know, there will be There will be problems in individual cases. There will be situations where a company does cut its dividends. So you don't want to be reliant on a too small a number of companies paying a dividend. And that has been an issue in the UK market, because a very high proportion of the total dividend income in the UK is represented by, you know, a relatively small number of companies. And I think it's important also to just strike a note of caution about chasing dividend yield. You know, there is a reason why dividend yields can seem very high. You know, if you see a company apparently offering a 7 or 8% dividend yield, that is probably telling you something important about the sustainability of that dividend. It's probably telling you that other people in the market don't actually think it likely that that dividend is going to be paid at that level for the foreseeable future. So I think, you know, it's important to be realistic about dividend. If you can find companies that are paying a 4, 4.5% dividend and can do it sustainably, fantastic. So don't go chasing that 6, 7, 8% dividend yield, because chances are it won't actually be paid.
Okay. Well, Tom, dividends weren't the only subject I wanted to talk to you about today. IHT is also on the radar, inheritance tax. We have had new figures from HMRC about the amounts being taken in via inheritance tax. They show that the average IHT bill grew to more than £209,000. That's up 6% in the last available figures. Bills were also higher, perhaps unsurprisingly, in wealthier areas of the country like London and the South East. But yet still only 4% of estates pay the tax. Tom, the interesting thing about these figures that were out in the last week or so is that they are backward looking. They are looking at the year 2018-19, which is actually 3 years ago. The reason that they're that far out of date is that the process of probate and administrating estates takes a long time. So it takes a long time for the money to actually land with the tax man. But we have the figures now, and they show these increases. Given what's happened in the time since these figures were actually applied, Tom, in the last 3 years, it's probably fair to say that they're going to rise even more in the future, aren't they? Because estates are probably larger for all sorts of reasons.
Yes, I think that's an entirely reasonable conclusion. I think, you know, we've seen significant rises in asset prices, whether that's stock market investments or particularly house prices. And let's not forget that for most people, the biggest asset that they will own, you know, when they come to die and to pass their money on to their families, is probably their house. So that's probably the most important thing to look at here. And house prices have risen very, very strongly in recent years. So yes, I think it's entirely possible that inheritance tax receipts will rise, and not least because the allowances, the sort of tax-free allowances, have risen considerably less quickly than asset prices. In fact, they've not risen at all in recent years.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the budget comes around each year, Tom, and we basically joke about this, don't we? That people say, oh, yeah, the IHT allowance has been frozen again. Well, it seems to be in permafrost, because it never changes. Although, having, you know, written about IHT for many years, there have been elements of the system that have got more generous. One of those is around people's primary residence. You get an extra amount of allowance that can be passed on. And you'll hear this figure of potentially a £1 million property can be passed on without IHT applying. You know, let's dwell on this point about house prices, because as I say, the IHT figures are quite out of date. Some more up-to-date figures that we have had today, in fact, we're recording on Wednesday this week, is around house prices in the UK rising, I think, more than 13% in the past year. They've been flying up, and IHT is one of the areas, there are others as well, but it's one of the areas where this does create a bit of a headache, because as you say there, you know, if most of your wealth is tied up in a property, you can't sort of finesse your finances in a way to dodge the tax, frankly, that you might be able to, in a way that you might be able to do if you were much wealthier. You can't give away part of a house, so it's hard to. So it's very illiquid from that point of view. And so it creates a very particular problem for a narrow group of people, as I say, because not everyone is going to pay IHT. And in the overall scope, these are wealthy people. But it's going to create a headache for a certain type of person and family and estate.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, it's often said that, IHT is a tax that, you know, it's really a middle class tax, because, you know, if you're wealthy enough, then you can find, legal things to do to shelter your money from taxation. And that is obviously easier to do with more liquid assets than property. There are various mechanisms for sheltering your money in that way, which are more difficult when it comes to your house. But as you hinted at earlier on, there are specific measures in place to protect the value of a house from inheritance tax, and you know, they have been finessed in a way to arrive at this rather nice round figure of £1 million, and obviously, you know, that, you know, you, to get to that £1 million, you know, you have to add in the property, you have to add in the fact that you're passing it on to your spouse. So, you know, it's a very specific answer that arrives at that £1 million, but nonetheless, it is real. And so therefore, inheritance tax does remain a problem for relatively wealthy people, as you say.
Yeah. And here we should say, I think, Tom, you know, if people are sort of worrying about these issues, perhaps, I mean, they might be nowhere near their own demise here. It might be many years in advance, which is probably a good thing, because some of the mechanisms for beating the tax, if we can put it that way, rely on the passage of time. People might have heard of the 7-year rule of gifts. If you make a gift of money to someone, 7 years have to pass before it will completely fall out of your estate from an IHT point of view. That is just one aspect of a quite complicated system. People's circumstances are going to be very specific to them and their families. And it's one of those occasions, Tom, where if people believe they've got an issue with IHT, financial advice can be really, really valuable here. And at perhaps a time far in advance of when they perhaps think they need that advice.
Yes, absolutely. Because no one knows what the future holds. And, you know, at a certain stage in your life, 7 years can, you know, be very important. And you don't know, you know, if you're still going to be around in 7 years. So you do need to think about these things in advance. I think there are certain times in everyone's life where, you know, taking advice on your finances, you know, makes a lot of sense. You know, I mean, coming up to retirement is one obvious time. You know, if you're going through a big life change, you know, whether, you know, that might be getting divorced or some other change in your family circumstances, that might be another. But planning for you know, the end of your life and handing your money on to make sure that your loved ones, you know, receive, you know, the maximum amount, which is what we would all like to do, of course, is something that does require some very specifics and quite detailed and quite technical advice. And for most people, it would make sense to go to a qualified advisor to give them that.
Okay. Well, Tom, that is all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Ed.
You've been listening to the Money Talk podcast. Check fidelity.co.uk for daily written updates and articles on these and other topics from across Fidelity in the UK. And subscribe via iTunes to get the podcast downloaded direct to your devices every week. Please be aware that the value of investments and the income you get from them can go down as well as up, so you may not get back what you invest. This information doesn't constitute investment advice and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision, nor should it be treated as a recommendation for any investment. Eligibility to invest in an ISA or a pension and the value of tax savings depends on personal circumstances, and all tax rules may change. You will not normally be able to access money held in a pension until the age of 55, reference to specific securities or funds should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell these securities or funds, and is included for the purpose of illustration only. Fidelity Personal Investing does not give personal recommendations. If you're unsure about the suitability of an investment, you should speak to an authorized financial advisor.